Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto and Dorothy Gundy. Anna Mateo will have this week's words and their stories, and later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
Imagine you are about to complete high school and are thinking about attending a college or university. After doing some research, you find a school you would like to attend, but have questions about the admissions process. So you go to the school's website in hopes of finding a few answers. Time goes by and you still do not have the answers. You almost feel like giving up. But then a message appears on your computer or personal electronic device. It says something like, "How can I help?" Writing back to the website, you try to explain your problem. You possibly get a few questions in response to clarify what your concerns are. Then, almost immediately, the person with whom you are in contact provides the information you are seeking. Except you are not actually communicating with a school official. You are not even dealing with a human being. You are in contact with a computer program or chatbot. It is using artificial intelligence, AI for short, to understand and communicate with you. This might sound strange, but chances are this would not be the first time you have communicated with a computer program without knowing it. In recent years, chatbots have become a common tool for banks and large companies around the world.
Having human beings available to answer people's questions and complaints can be costly, requiring many workers. And in most cases, employees can only work a set number of hours in a day, increasing the amount of time customers wait for a response. So, not just companies, but a growing number of colleges and universities have also begun using chatbot technology, says Keith Rejecki. He is with Oracle Higher Education, a computer software company that serves these institutions. Oracle offers several software tools now in use at hundreds of schools in the United States, the United Arab Emirates, and other countries. These tools help with almost everything, from academic record keeping to employee services, and most include a chatbot in their programming. Rejecki notes that reducing costs and response times is one of the main reasons schools and companies are turning to this technology. However, the goal of many colleges and universities is to find ways to better serve students. Part of that relates to the fact that the current generation of college students are used to communicating online, said Rejecki. They already talk with their friends and family members through social media messaging services like Facebook and WeChat. But most importantly, he said, students want support outside of the hours when it is normally available.
Yes, traditional students are in the class at set hours. But the reality is, a lot of the work that they do and continued interaction with the institution takes place outside of the classroom, online, day and night, Rejecki told VOA. Australia's University of Adelaide noted major improvements in its service to students after deploying an Oracle chatbot to deal with admissions questions in 2018. It said that students received responses 13 times faster, and students' approval of the quality of service increased by 60%. Now Oracle is offering one program for all areas of support services that colleges or universities provide to their students and employees. This includes a chatbot that can do everything from helping students register for classes to helping professors request time off. Oracle is not the only company working on this kind of technology. Businesses like AdmitHub and Ivy.ai are involved in similar efforts. Several schools have also created their own systems. Western Governors University, or WGU, operates completely online, meaning it has no actual grounds or physical campus. In 2018, the school's nonprofit research agency, WGU Labs, received a $750,000 award from the National Science Foundation to experiment with a new kind of chatbot. "We're not trying to create a bot that answers simple questions or anything like that," said Jason Levin, the executive director of WGU Labs. "We're really trying to create an agent that can help decision-making for students." Like Oracle, WGU's chatbot software will use machine learning to study past interactions between students and other chatbots, Levin said. This will enable the program's artificial intelligence to continuously learn and improve its communication skills.
But additionally, he noted, the goal is to collect information about the school's students. This includes expectations on how much time they can commit to their studies, how long they think a study program should take to complete, and what kind of career they want. Then, when a student who is unsure of the program or field of study they are interested in visits the WGU website, they can interact with the chatbot. This chatbot can then help the student find the program that best meets their needs. It may even suggest they are too busy to seek higher education at that time to ensure they do not try and fail, said Levin. However, not everyone is ready to consider the possibilities this kind of technology presents. Ian Jacobs is with the market research company Forrester. He suggests that technology like chatbots can work well if it is able to do what users ask of it. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
And now it's time for Words and Their Stories. On our program today, we will talk about seasons. In some places, there are four: winter, spring, summer, and autumn. Many areas in Earth's northern hemisphere have just experienced a change of seasons from summer to autumn. Hours of daylight grow shorter, and temperatures drop. Nature is entering a quiet phase. Flowering plants stop producing flowers. Leaves growing on some trees change color, die, and fall to the ground. Some animals become less active and hibernate during the winter months. Nature has its phases, and so do we. Like seeds shooting signs of life through the soil Spring is a time of rebirth. If it were likened to a human life, spring is the time when we enter the world as innocent as a newborn baby. Then babies become toddlers. They learn the word no and use it a lot. Bad behavior can be a problem during this period. No wonder it is often called the terrible twos. But other than this terrible part, childhood is a magical time, or at least it should be, when everything seems possible. However, those feelings of wonder are often dampened during a child's adolescence. The growing pains and angst of the teenage years can be a dark time indeed. But then we become young adults. We try to make it on our own. For many people, their 20s and 30s are the prime of life. This is the time when they are at their personal best. But the prime of life can happen at any time. Some people peak really early. They hit their prime in high school or college. After that, it may be all downhill. He or she is filled with memories of the glory days, always reliving an earlier, happier time. Other people may be late bloomers. They do not hit their peak until much later in life. And still others live their lives as if the best is yet to come, always. Whenever you peak, we all begin to slow down a bit. As we age, we hit a phase that some people call midlife. In this phase, we are busy working and possibly raising a family. Even though we are busy, we may feel that life has become predictable. So this is when many people want to change things a lot. They have a so-called midlife crisis, or two. They may buy a really fast motorcycle, get a tattoo, or take up a new and dangerous hobby like skydiving. But this passes and things calm down again as we enter the next phase, the autumn years. If spring is the season of being born, autumn is the season of dying, or at least slowing down for the winter. Our autumn years is the period after we retire from work and start to slow down. Many people love this phase and enjoy their time in retirement. However, we have other terms that describe this latter part of life. You might hear them called the twilight years. For many, this could suggest that the end is near. So perhaps a better expression is the golden years. This describes a time that is carefree and easy. Golden, you might say. You finally hit a phase where you don't have to care about what other people think anymore. Perhaps this is why we sometimes call the autumn years, or golden years, a second childhood. We can live like a child again, hopefully without a care in the world. Some people, in their autumn years of life, may have some regrets. But seriously, who wouldn't? Nearly everyone has a few what-ifs and should-haves. But as we say, you can't change the past. You can only look to the future, whatever stage of life you are in. And that's Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo. Thank you.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of Andrew Jackson. Jackson took office in 1829. He was popular with many voters. They saw him as the symbol of the common man. But Jackson's first term seemed to be mostly a political battle with his vice president, John C. Calhoun. As his presidency went on, another struggle began. This time, it was Jackson against the Bank of the United States. The first Bank of the United States had closed in 1811. But without a central bank, the country's finances had suffered during the War of 1812. So in 1816, Congress provided money to establish the Second Bank of the United States. The bank could provide loans, pay bills, collect taxes, and move money around the country. Congress gave the bank a charter to do business for 20 years. The government owned one-fifth of the bank. A small group of private citizens owned the rest. Lawmakers gave the bank enormous power. The Bank of the United States had $35 million in capital. Some of that money came from the government. Most came from investors. Historian Bray Hammond notes that at the time, the Bank of the United States was the richest corporation in the world. The Bank of the United States also printed the country's paper money, and it was the only bank permitted to have offices across the nation. By making it easy or difficult for businesses to borrow money, the bank's owners could control the economy in almost any part of the United States.
What this means is that you are granting, and Congress did grant, exclusive privileges to the Bank of the United States, which meant exclusive money-making opportunities to its stockholders.
Historian Daniel Feller explains that the Bank of the United States helped the government to do its business effectively and efficiently. But it also helped the people who owned stock in the bank. During Jackson's presidency, a man named Nicholas Biddle led the Bank of the United States. Biddle was an extremely intelligent man. He had completed his studies at the University of Pennsylvania when he was only 13 years old. When he was 18, he was sent to Paris as secretary to the American minister. During America's war with Britain in 1812, Biddle helped establish the Bank of the United States. He became its president when he was only 37 years old. Biddle clearly understood his power as president of the Bank of the United States. In his mind, the government had no right to interfere in any way with the bank's business. President Jackson did not agree, nor was he very friendly toward the bank. Not many people from Western states were. They did not trust the bank's paper money. They wanted to deal in gold and silver. Jackson criticized the bank in each of his yearly messages to Congress. He said the Bank of the United States was dangerous to the liberty of the people. He said the bank could build up or pull down political parties through loans to politicians. Jackson opposed giving the bank a new charter. He proposed that a new bank be formed as part of the Treasury Department. The president urged Congress to consider the future of the bank long before the bank's charter was to end in 1836. Then, if the charter was rejected, the bank could close its business slowly over several years. Changing the banking system slowly, Jackson said, would prevent serious economic problems for the country. But the bank's president wanted to renew the charter early. He made the request in January 1832, 9 months before the next presidential election. Jackson's opponent, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky, was sure that the issue of the bank could win him some votes. Clay argued his case on the floor of the Senate for 3 days. He strongly urged the Senate to renew the bank's charter. He said the country was in the middle of a revolution, not yet a bloody revolution, but things were happening that pointed to a total change of the pure Republican character of the government. Power was being centered in the hands of one man, he said. He meant President Jackson. Clay added that if Congress did not act, the government would fail. Clay then asked the Senate to condemn Jackson, saying he violated the Constitution and the nation's laws. The Senate approved the resolution. The chief opponent to the bank was Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. He objected to the renewal of the charter, he told the Senate, because the bank was too great and powerful and made the rich richer and the poor poorer. The Senate finally voted on the bank's new charter. The vote was 28 for renewal and 20 against. The House voted 3 weeks later. It also approved the charter, 107-85. The lawmakers sent the bill to the White House. President Jackson debated it with members of his cabinet. Some wanted to negotiate a compromise, but Jackson decided to veto the bill in the strongest possible language. On July 10, 1832, Jackson sent a message to Congress explaining his reasoning. Jackson said he did not believe the bank's charter was constitutional. Jackson also spoke of the way the bank moved money from west to east. He said the bank was owned by a small group of rich men, mostly in the east. Some of the owners, he said, were foreigners. Much of the bank's business was done in the west. The money paid by Westerners for loans went into the pockets of the Eastern bankers. Jackson said this was wrong. Then the president spoke of his firm belief in the rights of the common man. It is to be regretted, he said, that the rich and powerful bend the acts of the government to their own purposes. Jackson said that instead, the government should shower its favors, as heaven does its rain, on the high and low alike, on the rich and the poor equally. Jackson's veto of the bank bill may have cost him votes among the wealthy, but it earned him votes among the common people, like farmers and laborers. He easily won re-election in November of 1832. Martin Van Buren became his vice president. Historian Daniel Fellers says Jackson believed his victory meant that Americans supported his policies, including the bank veto.
he had a very popular personal image. It's possible he would have been reelected by the same margin or larger anyway. The one thing we can say looking forward is that when later on you had somebody carrying on Jackson's policies absolutely faithfully, without Jackson's personal charisma, he proved to be not nearly so popular.
In his second term, Jackson stopped putting federal money into the Bank of the United States. Instead, he put the money into state banks. The bank president, Nicholas Biddle, fought with all his power to keep the bank open. He demanded that borrowers immediately repay their loans. Businesses struggled without the bank's assistance. Workers lost their jobs. Biddle blamed President Jackson for the financial panic. Critics of Jackson's bank policy called him King Andrew I. But as time passed, business people began to see that the Bank of the United States was being much tighter in its money policy than was necessary. They began to feel that it was the bank's president, not Jackson, who was responsible for the serious economic situation in the country. Biddle took no responsibility for the financial crisis. He then made a very bad decision. Biddle asked the governor of Pennsylvania to make a speech supporting the bank. At the same time, Biddle refused to lend the state of Pennsylvania $300,000. The governor was furious. Instead of making a speech supporting the bank, he made one that sharply criticized it. 2 days later, the governor of New York proposed that the state sell $4 or $5 million of stock for loans to help state banks. The New York legislature approved selling even more. Strengthening state banks helped break the power of the Bank of the United States. Nicholas Biddle began to see that the battle was lost. He started making more loans to businesses. The economic panic slowly ended. Jackson's victory over the Bank of the United States was clear. Biddle started to lose the support of many members of Congress. In the House of Representatives, James Polk proposed 4 resolutions about the bank. One said the bank should not get a new charter in 1836. The second resolution said government money should not be deposited in the bank. The third said the government should continue to put its money in state banks. And the fourth proposed an investigation of the bank and the reasons for the economic panic in the country. All 4 of these anti-bank resolutions were approved. One of Biddle's aides described the feelings of bank officials. "This day," he said, "should be ripped from the history of the Republic." He said the President of the United States had seized the public treasury and the representatives of the people had approved it. Jackson won what he himself considered a glorious triumph. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.